Barry Schultz, and I represent the plaintiff, Howard Kanur, this morning. The objective evidence in Mr. Kanur's disability claim established that on MRI he had 4 compression fractures of his thoracic spine. He had cervical spondylosis and lumbar spondylosis, as well as peripheral vascular disease and symptoms of intermittent claudication. The treating physician in Mr. Kanur's claim provided the opinion that he required a sit-stand option, that he needed to be able to sit or stand every 20 to 30 minutes on any job that he might get, along with initially a lifting limitation to 30 pounds. The doctor then revised her opinion, or modified her opinion, and limited Mr. Kanur to lifting 10 pounds and to bending at a degree of no more than 30 degrees. According to the regulations at 20 CFR section 404.1527, at times the opinion of a treating physician is entitled to controlling weight. But according also to that regulation, even where the opinion of a treating physician is not entitled to controlling weight, that opinion still must be considered by the administrative law judge and must be considered following all of the factors set forth in the regulation. In addition, in Social Security ruling 96-2P, the commissioner specifically sets forth that even where the opinion of a treating physician is not well supported by the objective evidence, or even if it's inconsistent with other substantial evidence of record, that all that means is that the opinion is not entitled to controlling weight. According to the ruling, that treating physician's opinion is still entitled to deference and must be weighed and evaluated pursuant to the factors set forth in the regulation. And the ruling says, quote, in many cases, the treating source's medical opinion will be entitled to the greatest weight and should be adopted, even if it does not meet the test for controlling weight. And the problem with the administrative law judge's decision is that she only made reference to one of the limitations set forth by the treating doctor. That was the limitation to lifting 10 pounds. The ALJ found that that opinion was not entitled to controlling weight. However, at no time does she then analyze the treating doctor's opinion pursuant to the factors set forth in the regulation. She says it's not entitled to controlling weight, and that's the end of her evaluation, which is a clear violation of the procedure set forth by the commissioner, both in the regulations and in the ruling. The error is even greater when you look at the treating physician's opinion concerning the requirement of a sit-stand option. There, at the end of the rationale of her opinion, the ALJ says, even though not so limited, a significant number of the jobs mentioned by the vocational expert would allow for a sit-stand option. The ALJ provides no rationale for finding that Mr. Kanur was not limited to a sit-stand option. She does not discuss the doctor's opinion, does not say whether or not or why that opinion is not entitled to controlling weight under the regulation, and again, does not follow the regulations at all in analyzing that opinion. Curiously, the ALJ made the finding that even though not so limited, there are a significant number of jobs that Mr. Kanur could perform which would allow for a sit-stand option, because the vocational expert did not provide any testimony to that fact. That question was not put to the vocational expert, and the ALJ did not rely on any vocational resource to make that finding. She merely made that fact up, as it is totally unsupported in the record. And this court has held in the case of Peterson versus Chater that where a sit-stand option is required, an administrative law judge must rely on vocational testimony or some other vocational resource to determine whether there are jobs available which a person could perform where there must be a sit-stand option allowed. And an even greater error is made by the ALJ with regard to the limitation to no bending past 30 degrees, which is a very significant limitation in the ability to bend. The ALJ ignores that opinion completely, provides no basis for rejecting the opinion, and doesn't analyze it pursuant to the regulations. The regulations require that an ALJ generally give greater weight to the opinion of a treating physician over a non-treating physician, an examining physician versus a non-examining physician, give great weight to the opinion of a doctor who's treated a patient over a long period of time. The opinions of specialists are entitled to greater weight than opinions of non-specialists, and to the extent that there are opinions by non-examining doctors, the weight to be given those opinions must be based upon the extent to which those doctors reviewed all of the evidence of record, including the opinions of the treating physician. And in this case, both of the non-examining physicians provided their opinion that there was no treating physician opinion in the record, which is error and clearly shows that those doctors did not consider the treating doctor's opinion. Every single factor in the regulation favors giving either controlling or great weight to the opinion of Dr. Lee Sigler, and none of the factors favor giving controlling or giving great weight, to the opinions of the non-examining physician. The ALJ erred in this regard. Additionally, the ALJ found Mr. Cunningham not completely credible. She found that his activities of daily living indicate the capacity for work. However, even the ALJ's own recitation of those daily activities included only having coffee and eating breakfast, watching television, reading a book, reading a newspaper, occasionally visiting with people, going for a car ride, that Mr. Cunningham had gone grocery shopping and bought a loaf of bread and a book, that he could work on a computer. Those are exactly the kinds of activities that this court has held in cases such as Rousey versus Heckler and Zarowski versus Halter and Clifford versus Apfel, that they do not establish the ability to sustain full-time, even sedentary work, let alone light work, as was found in this case. In addition, the ALJ found that Mr. Cunningham did not have the usual signs of severe pain, which he found would be weight loss and muscle atrophy, and that he did not go to the emergency room or have inpatient hospitalization. There is no medical opinion that a person with the impairments of Mr. Cunningham would be expected to have weight loss or would be expected to experience muscle atrophy. Nor did any doctor provide an opinion that if Mr. Cunningham were truly in the severe pain to which he testified, that he should have gone to the emergency room or been hospitalized for his condition. And this court has held in the case of Hayes versus Railroad Retirement Board that in the absence of a medical opinion indicating that there are specific findings which one would expect for a given claimant depending on their medical condition, that an ALJ errs in rejecting credibility based on the absence of those findings. And there was no medical opinion in this case which supports the ALJ's determination. Finally, the ALJ ignored objective evidence of peripheral vascular disease. There was evidence that Mr. Kreiner suffered from the symptoms of intermittent claudication, which is cramping in both legs and both feet on exercise. There was a specific test given him which showed that he had a moderate reduction in his blood flow to his leg, which would cause this cramping. The ALJ does not mention this objective evidence. She does not give any credence to the evidence of peripheral vascular disease, and she basically rejects any limitation due to the heart disease.
Mr. Schultz, I waited, I didn't want to break the train of thought, but I would appreciate your comments on Dr. Lee Sigler's recommendation of the sit-stand option. I read page 26 of your brief. You seem to take exception to the way the ALJ dealt with that sit-stand option.
That's correct.
Can you elaborate a little bit for me as to precisely the gravamen of your complaint with respect to that issue?
Yes. All the ALJ said was, even though not so limited, there are jobs available which allow a sit-stand option. That's her only discussion of it. She provides no rationale as to why Mr. Conner would not be expected to have need the sit-stand option. She doesn't discuss the medical evidence in regards to that specific finding.
So she notes the sit-stand option. Does she attribute it to Dr. Lee Sigler?
When she's summarizing the evidence, she notes that the doctor did provide the opinion of the sit-stand option.
So your complaint is not that the ALJ didn't mention it, but that the ALJ didn't analyze it.
There's no analysis at all. That's correct.
I see. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Nice counsel.
May it please the court.
Contrary to Mr. Conor's contention, the ALJ's decision does provide an adequate basis for declining to accept Dr. Lee Sigler's sit-stand limitation. First, the ALJ cites the June 1998 formal physical capacity evaluation, which did not include a sit-stand limitation, and indeed, the physical therapist there concluded that Mr. Conor could perform light work, could perform the standing and walking requirements, as well as the lifting requirements for light work. The ALJ then cites Dr. Lee Sigler's initial concurrence with that physical capacity evaluation. After that, Mr. Conor complained that he was very dissatisfied with the recommendation that he could return to work. The ALJ then discounts a later Dr. Lee Sigler opinion, the one in which she imposes a 10-pound lifting requirement, because it was obviously given in response to the claimant's subjective complaints of pain rather than objective findings, and contradicts the findings of the formal physical capacity evaluation. Accordingly, it's reasonable to conclude from the decision that the ALJ also declined to accept the sit-stand limitation because it too was given in response to Mr. Knorr's complaints, subjective complaints of pain, rather than an objective deterioration in his medical condition. And we detail that the lack of any deterioration in his medical condition in our brief. Now, with respect to the bending limitation, Mr. Knorr did not raise that directly in his opening brief, nor did he raise it at the district court. And therefore, he's waived that argument. But even if that argument's not waived, the ALJ's decision also provides an adequate basis for declining to accept that. Dr. Lee Sigler indicated that she adopted the 30-degree bending limitation because the formal physical capacity evaluation by the physical therapist noted a decreased tolerance to bending. However, the physical capacity evaluation did not impose a 30-degree limit on bending. It only indicated that Mr. Knorr could only bend occasionally to very occasionally, which is very different from a complete ban on bending past 30 degrees. The state agency physicians, who also reviewed the evidence of record, concluded that Mr. Knorr could perform occasional bending. The ALJ therefore imposed a restriction on repetitive bending, but did not impose a complete ban on any bending past 30 degrees. And with respect to Mr. Knorr's argument that the state agency physicians failed to note Dr. Lee Sigler's opinion, at the time that they reviewed the evidence of record, Dr. Lee Sigler's sit-stand limitation was not in the record. So they reviewed the evidence that was then before them, and based upon that, concluded that Mr. Knorr could perform light work. So they didn't overlook any evidence. It just simply wasn't a part of the record at the time. So their opinions do provide some support for the ALJ's finding. Given that Dr. Lee Sigler's later, more restrictive opinions, that is after her initial concurrence with the physical capacity evaluation, given that these later, more restrictive opinions were not entitled to significant weight, the evidence of record does provide adequate support, ample support, actually, for the ALJ's finding that Mr. Knorr can perform a range of light work. There are no further questions.
All right, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will take the case under advisement at this time.